said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Alan Light, an old friend, music writer with the New York Times, Rolling Stone, studied American Studies at Yale University, and has been with me before. Today, in the holiday experience at the end of an amazingly turbulent year, 2020, I asked Alan to join me and talk about how music, poetry, literature, and other things impacted him in this year, and what he sees on the horizon for the coming year, and how the arts relate to our spirit. Alan, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here, Rob.
So, what looking backwards first, what stands at the top of your mind or spirit?
Well,
when we talked earlier in the year, I remember there was some Leonard Cohen kind of lurking around in February, March, but where are you now?
Well, you know, thinking about music this year, obviously is like everything else, so incredibly complicated. Particularly because of the, you know, the removal of live music as part of our experience, that without any kind of performance, without any kind of audience, without even encountering music in so many of the public, just hearing music from cars that are passing or in restaurants when you're out, or all of the things that sort of connect you to sound in your life. Obviously, almost all of that was erased, and it was a much more insular, individual, one-on-one listening at home or through headphones exclusively kind of an experience this year. That's really different, especially for those of us who sort of live in this world every day. It completely reframes the way that you think about a lot of these things. Now, fortunately, coincidentally or not, whether it was a result of how it is that we could listen or what it was that people were doing, I think that there was a lot of really, really exceptionally good new recorded music that came out this year. A lot of music that I was really excited about, a lot from artists who we had not really heard from for a while, who, you know, happened to choose this moment to come back and released some stuff that I think was really, you know, was really strong, really important to me, and certainly helped get through the madness that was 2020 one way or another.
Yeah, ma'am. Well, when you started off, none of us could understand quite what the pandemic was, where it was coming from, etc. And I remember you and I talked a little bit about you too had certain resonance, kind of a spiritual urging you on or what have you, but and that Leonard Cohen brought you to the ominous places. But as the year went on, I remember doing things like going up to Smoke Jazz, and they had plexiglass compartments outside of the jazz club where you could go in and eat. They would serve you through kind of a door, which you'd be sealed off, and they would pipe in some of their jazz recordings or recent jazz live shows that they had made in the studio for you.
Well, I think what's, you know, what is really fascinating, you know, we'll see longer term, but I remember, so I host a show every day on Sirius XM, talk show about music, and as
well, debatable, is that right?
Debatable,
channel 106,
volume channel 106, and right as the, you know, the in the early days in March when this was starting, I got a call, you know, that whatever that there was that week where it started, you know, things started to explode. And on the Wednesday night, I guess, I got a call from my producer, from our executive producer of the channel, saying, you can't come back in. There's the possibility that anybody who was working in our studio was exposed because one of the producers on one of the other shows in our studio had a roommate who was maybe exposed or was maybe sick. It did turn out that that person ultimately tested positive. The producer didn't get sick, but all of us who had been in the studio, we couldn't come back in. We had to go straight to quarantine. And so I remember being on the phone the next day with our substitute hosts who were on, and we were, you know, starting to talk about what it all might mean. That the next day, the Friday, was the day that Broadway closed, all the venues closed, Live Nation said that all tours were stopped, everything shut down, you know, that Friday. And I remember talking on the phone on our show and saying, there is all of this technology that exists. It's not a question of developing new technology. People have been experimenting with virtual reality live music performances. They've been experimenting with putting music performances into video games. They've been trying to do different things that are broadcasts and live streams. And this is going to be the big test to see what are people going to respond to, what is going to stick. It's not going to be a question of needing to invent stuff. It's going to be a question of determining what is of interest to listeners and viewers, and how are those things going to get refined. And that was immediately clear, and has certainly been the story in music for the, whatever it is, 8 months since then, of really this evolution, this creation of an entirely new format, an entirely new way to present music that very rapidly went from, you know, point your iPhone at yourself and sit on your couch and play an acoustic guitar, to more and more produced, you know, some of these really kind of spectacle events. Billie Eilish did this very elaborate CGI, you know, a sort of visual performance that you never could have done on stage, and sold millions of tickets against that. And there's no question that some of these things are going to be things that will stay around and be part of our music experience, even when we're able to go back and go out to see live music again. There are things that have emerged that I think are going to transform our experience of music moving forward.
Well, I think that I saw lots of artists, John Legend and others, experimenting with new ways of reaching their audiences. Yeah. And the economics had to be quite distressful for a lot of them.
Yes and no. I mean, the overall economics obviously are really, you know, incredibly, you know, difficult and bleak. But if, you know, if the BTS, Dua Lipa, Billie Eilish, some of the big pop stars were doing, again, ticketed live streams, selling tickets against those performances and selling millions. The Dua Lipa performance, broadcast from London, did 5 million views, you know, I forget exactly what the price point is, but let's say $20 a shot. That's a lot of money for something you do once. You know, you're not hauling yourself around with 16 semi-trailers and showing up in arenas and hauling yourself around the world. You're not carrying all of those kinds of expenses. You're essentially playing to a tour's worth of audience in one night for the expense of just mounting that once. That's, you know, for those kind of artists, that's not a bad economic model. And when you think about the old, I mean, we don't know, are the Stones, are, you know, is Paul McCartney, is Bob Dylan, are those guys ever going to be able to go out and play again? Are they going to, you know, are we going to reach a point where the risk is minimal enough and, you know, the travel is safe and secure enough, you know, as they're each sort of bumping up or over 80 years old? Those guys have to be looking at those kind of things and saying, well, maybe we play a couple of shows in a small club for, you know, an exorbitant ticket price, and then we beam those out to the world and millions of people watch that. And that's a, you know, a hell of a lot more attractive option than dragging ourselves around the world one more time.
So, Alan, obviously there's a lot of change in technology, the change in way artists reach us, the way they perform. There are historic records, but there are also people inspired by the current circumstance. What did you What did you hear this year? What set you ablaze?
Yeah, I mean, there were, I think there were a number, you know, usually get to the end of the year and I've got to come up with, you know, a 10, top 10 albums list. And I can always find 10 things that I liked. But, you know, realistically, I always kind of feel like if there's one or two of those that I feel like 5 years from now, I'm going to still listen to, you know, that's pretty good. And this year, I really do feel like there were, you know, four or five albums that I think are going to stick around for a while. And I think especially notable this year was music that was coming from women. I think there was a lot of really strong, probably more related to coming out of where the world was, you know, before all of this, and music that was written more in response to the Me Too moment or, you know, different things that we saw over the last several years that led to things that women were writing that by the time they were recorded and out were, you know, got us into this year. But I think, you know, she's long been a favorite of mine. Fiona Apple put out an album called Fetch the Bolt Cutters this year that I think is extraordinary. I really do believe that she's the great songwriter of her generation. And I think she made an album that doesn't sound like or play like anything else. I think it's really, really an exceptional record. I am a big fan of Taylor Swift. I think what she's doing within the pop, whatever it is, pop arena is, you know, remains really consistently impressive and rewarding. Of course, she put out two surprise albums recorded, you know, under lockdown, working largely with Aaron Dessner from the band The National and some of his associates. And it's definitely a more quiet indie rock, introspective, contemplative sort of a thing, writing much more in characters and telling stories rather than in confessional. And I think those records are very, very strong. The women of the band Haim made a record called Women in Music Part 3 that I think, you know, really, really good. A band I've liked for a long time, but definitely sort of elevating into something stronger and more consistent. A band of a very mysterious British R&B group called Salt, S-A-U-L-T, who nobody really knows. There are no photos. People have kind of pieced together who they are. But it's a very sort of old school R&B groove, almost a jazzy, like almost a Roy Ayers kind of a thing. They put out two albums this year, both untitled. One was called Untitled Black Is. One was Untitled Rise. And those ultimately for me were the albums that spoke the most to the protest moment this year, to the Black Lives Matter, you know, visibility and awareness and street action this year. It's just, you know, a more subtle but more powerful kind of a statement record of Black empowerment and identity than I heard from anybody else. Run the Jewels were certainly the hip hop group. Their RTJ4 album spoke the most directly to a time of protest and action. Killer Mike from Run the Jewels, people may have seen, he was one of the folks who got up and spoke in Atlanta after the protests began after George Floyd's murder, and Mayor Bottoms brought out several people to speak to the community, and Killer Mike was one of those, very involved and associated. He was very involved in the Bernie Sanders campaign. So all of those were records that were really important to me, and I know you and I share that the new Bob Dylan album, Rough and Rowdy Ways, in ways that, you know, nobody ever necessarily would have anticipated, got to a mood about this year, about staring down our seclusion and mortality in ways that are uniquely his own, and a different kind of writing for him, even at this phase, this deep into his career, a different kind of singing, and still just an extraordinary achievement for a guy who's going to be 80 years old next year.
Murder Most Foul was the one he opened with, and I remember
Leading with a you know, sort of really as lockdown was settling in, that he, you know, out of nowhere put out a 17-minute monologue, kind of riffing on and reconstructing the JFK assassination, but really kind of bearing witness to the 60 years since then, connecting a lot of feelings about, you know, the things that music did or didn't do to pull the world through, you know, the upheaval of those times. It was, you know, the fact that he had that there in the chamber ready to go, and then the world sort of called for it. I guess that's what it is to, you know, to be that kind of artist where you're, you know, your antenna are up and you're anticipating certain needs and emotions from the world. But that sure was
he was almost intimating to us that the turmoil and the turbulence, which, leaving the pandemic aside, perhaps this year and the presidential election and the polarized identity politics and everything else, was not all new. Maybe he had teed up for that to release in the context of this tumultuous year, irrespective of the health scare. But I thought he reminded us that things have been in and out of balance and struggling for a long, long time.
Yeah, and as you say, that it doesn't come from nowhere. That you know, certainly it was easy for it was easy and in obviously in a lot of ways deserved to lay a lot of blame at this president and this administration that we've lived through for the last 4 years, but also the reminder that, you know, those are symptoms as much as they are causes, and that this kind of strife is not something that that manifests overnight. And Dylan pointing back to, you know, at least to 1963, to that sort of rift in the culture that, you know, the song kind of argued we'd never really been able to, you know, reconstruct and sew back together.
Yeah, I was talking with a theologian who's very musically sensitive. At the time when the horn started honking because Pennsylvania was declared for Joe Biden. And right. I remember him saying to me, this is going to be an eerie day, because in some ways what we're doing is celebrating that which we are celebrating something coming back to power, which is what produced the thing we're celebrating the departure of, meaning because of Biden's affiliation with the Obama administration and so forth.
Right.
That those were the thing. Trump didn't come from Mars. He came out of an unacknowledged dysfunction in this gentleman's mind, and that now we were going to go back to that, and that the danger might be, how would I say, step down acutely right. in the moment, but on trend, we've got a lot of repair work to do, which we can all be right. hopeful and not cynical that the administration now, the what you might call president, vice president-elect, and their future cabinet are sensitive to how ominous the right. circumstance is.
I mean, and look, what's musically going to be really, you know, endlessly fascinating to watch. Certainly they're worth, by the end of this year and throughout, you know, the summer and things like the Taylor Swift album, there were people who were making music out of lockdown, out of the pandemic, out of these current circumstances. The new Paul McCartney record, an example of, he was like everybody else, stuck at home with his family, not able to do much of anything else, and so was just making music, songs, sounds for his own, you know, for his own sake, and they took shape as an album that, you know, that grew out of this time. But there are whole genres, I mean, in the rock world, in the country world, I think there was the general feeling that those are so dependent on touring, particularly for new artists, but even for established artists, that everything was really kind of shelved until there's a sense that people can get back out there and perform again, because that's how they get that music out in front of people. So there's a big chunk of the music community that's really been on pause. And most of the music, even through till the fall, that was coming out, were things that were recorded before you know, before the lockdown, before the protests exploded, mm-hmm. before, you know, the absolute white heat of the election season. And, you know, what is music going to sound like next year is going to be, you know, really a really wild thing to watch. Mm-hmm. The big question early on this year was everybody trying to figure out, you know, should we be putting out? We've got an album finished. It's supposed to come out in March or April. Do we put it out? Do we delay it? Do we wait and see how things are going to shake out? What's the mood going to be? Some people who moved their albums up saying, you know what? I've got this. Let me put music in front of people. I feel like they need it. The, you know, Fiona Apple record was that. Dua Lipa, pop star who I really like a lot, pulled her record up to say maybe people want a happy dance record right now for some relief and some, you know, to take the pressure off a little bit. So everybody was kind of figuring out how to navigate what was going on, but we weren't yet hearing sort of the creative results of everything that's going on. And most of that is really still to come.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember you're the person who turned me on to the McCartney record was something you wrote for Esquire. Songs like Deep, Deep Feeling, Long-Tailed Winter Bird with the riff that you shared with me was so catchy. And now Winter Bird and White Winter, When Winter Comes is the, right. Winter's here now. I've been playing in the snow with my little ones today. But
and those songs that are just about, you know, I mean, I think to hear somebody, you know, age 78, not trying to make a great record, not trying to make a big statement, just trying to, you know, work out sounds for himself and what emotions he's feeling. I mean, that Deep, Deep Feeling song that you mentioned is really almost this kind of primal exploration of, you know, good and bad emotion. And these songs about tending to his farm and checking the fences and, you know, stopping up the holes. Well, at a time when we're all stuck at home and tending our own gardens and trying to just take care of the people around us, those kinds of little ideas and closer to home feelings and emotions, I think those land really powerfully right now. I think that album, without being, you know, intentionally not very, you know, not big, ambitious, not trying to be a big, you know, a big pop record for McCartney, I think it's all the more affecting for all of those reasons. And, you know, a thing that we sort of started talking about early in the, you know, early in lockdown days, so much of the basic vocabulary of pop songwriting, right, are, I want to hold your hand and put your head on my shoulder, like these basic phrases that are all about physical proximity and closeness, emotional closeness, you know, all of that just means something so different, sounds so different in the world that we live in right now. The hardest songs for me to listen to were things like, you know, When Will I See You Again by the Three mm-hmm. Degrees. That song puts me in tears to listen to that right now because of all the people that I don't know when I'm going to see them again. Reach out and touch somebody's hand. You know, all of these sort of old soul songs that, you know, you never thought about that imagery before. That's everything right now. So there's a lot that's still going to shift and transform, I think, at a very sort of fundamental level for pop music that's going to be coming out in whatever it is, the months or years ahead of us.
How'd I say, the events and episodes have reshaped our minds and spirits. The music will probably come to reflect some of those transitions and transformations.
It always does.
That's right. We've lost a number of wonderful artists this year. Mm-hmm. It's probably worth, underscoring some of those, like Bill Withers, I know, passed away, but who were some of those that were here for the last time this year?
Yeah. Well, there were a lot. I mean, I guess if you sort of separate out the COVID deaths as one category, mm-hmm. You know, there weren't the a lot of the shocking, you know, well before their time, or, you know, we didn't have the losses like a Prince or a David Bowie or those kind of figures. But, you know, time continues to march on. The loss of, you know, a titan like Little Richard is, you know, is obviously not shocking. He was certainly of that age. We know he had been, you know, not in great health for a long time. But, you know, we're almost at the place where we can't touch that generation of those rock and roll pioneers anymore. Jerry Lee Lewis, amazingly, is the one guy who's still out there. But, you know, in recent years, having lost, when we lost Johnny Cash, when we lost, you know, with Little Richard gone this year, with Chuck Berry, you know, a year or two mm-hmm. ago, you know, that whole moment, that whole wave is, you know, is almost gone, and just marks a generational and historical transition. Yeah. Bill Withers, you know, an amazing and again another fascinating story. A guy who walked away at the top of the game, made some extraordinary records that we, you know, songs that we still sing, that we still turn to today, and, you know, came from nowhere. Was a guy working, helping build aircraft carrier, helping build airplanes in a Boeing factory. All of a sudden showed up for a few years, was brilliant, and then just walked away from the entertainment business completely. Such a unique sound, that sort of country folk soul sound that was unlike anybody else. Really an amazing artist. And kind of in a related vein, you know, the great John Prine, who we did lose to COVID this year, who I would argue to this generation of Americana artists, of country singers, songwriters, you know, the folk world now, may be the most influential songwriter out there. I mean, he is the guy that when you talk to these young country songwriters, singers, sort of more alternative-y country artists, that's the guy that they bring up again and again and again. When you talk to Jason Isbell or Casey Musgraves or, you know, those kinds of artists, Prine was the absolute summit to them. The storytelling and the humor and the wryness of it, and the sort of deceptive folksiness of it that felt, you know, it didn't feel complicated, it didn't feel literary, but every word was flawless and conveyed such a sense of time, place, and feeling. That guy cast a massive shadow, and we'll hear the echoes of that for a long, long time.
We lost a little bit of reggae foundation. Toots Hibberts and Johnny Nash both parted with us this year.
Yeah, and passed right around the same time, I think, you know, a few days apart, if I recall. And Toots, you know, such a shame. I mean, he had fought his way, but he had this, you know, however many years ago, you know, this awful incident where somebody hit him on stage with a bottle that they had thrown, that he took a long time recovering from and getting back to where he wanted to perform again. And just as he had a new album coming out, his first new album in many, many years, he contracted the virus and was gone, pretty much, you know, right around day of album release. And God, I saw that guy give some unbelievably great shows. I think really the inheritor of the Otis Redding, you know, that sort of Southern soul singing. I don't think there's anybody who carried that forward as powerfully as Toots Hibbert did. The guy was a master vocalist. And, you know, I remember seeing him at this club in Jamaica. He had the flu. He was like, had a fever. He got out there and it was just some, there was the sense of like, oh yeah, okay, it's Toots getting up to sing it. Like it wasn't a big event, or he was just like, was some local club, and he was there and he sang, and he sounded so fantastic. And again, like nobody else who was still out there doing it.
Yeah, Love and Happiness, you know. Knock on Wood. I saw him.
That Toots in Memphis, I mean, aside from the Funky Kingston record and Pressure Drop and all that stuff, that Toots in Memphis record, that, you know, with those songs that you're talking about, is really, really exceptional and makes that link so explicit. Yeah.
And you see, you know, Al Green almost looking at it admiringly. And he's no small talent himself.
No slouch.
But, you know, I remember for myself this year, probably the album I listened to most often in terms of number of plays of the album, it was A Love Supreme by John Coltrane. And McCoy Tyner, who I met once, but he departed this year. And I enjoyed his solo work. I enjoyed, obviously, his work with Coltrane. And but I'm very sad about his, you know, how would I say, he lived a beautiful life. But
a magnificent player. And, you know, and we lost... You know, talk about losing links to those, you know, the chains in our history, losing McCoy Tyner from the John Coltrane Quartet and losing Jimmy Cobb, the drummer who was the last surviving member of Miles Davis kind of blue ensemble. The last guy who, you know, could still touch that, you know, most celebrated record. I mean, those Kind of Blue and Love Supreme, probably the two most beloved jazz albums of all time. And this year we lost the things that, you know, the guys who were still able to connect us to those. You know, now listen, that's 1959 and 1963, 62, 63. So it's not, you know, you can't say that these are gone way before their time or anything. But again, just in terms of what makes us feel connected to these landmarks in history, they just, you know, they get further and further in the rear view.
For me, the Little Richard departure had a certain resonance because when I first went into the music business, I was exploring working with Mick Taylor, who had left the Rolling Stones many years before and on a solo career. And I went to see him at the House of Blues on Sunset Boulevard. And at the same time, I was getting prepared or exploring working with Ike Turner. And I went across the street to have a brunch with him. And he came into the meeting and Ike says, Rob, I brought a friend of mine. I want you to meet Little Richard. And so I sat down at brunch with these two characters. And I didn't know Ike well at the time. But they started telling me stories about how it was to work with this guy named Jimmy James, who became Jimi Hendrix, and how apparently Little Richard said, this guy is just going to pick up and fly away someday, and Ike is a better band leader than me. You know, I kind of fly away too, he says. But then he says, but I knew Ike. You know, Ike could play that rhythm guitar. He could really keep that band under control. And Ike said, no, man, no, not with Jimmy James. Uh-uh. He was, you're right. He was on the takeoff ramp. And then you see what Hendrix became. I got such a thrill out of just hearing the two of them comparing notes about
that. Talk about history. That must have been, if you were there, must have been when Richard was still living at the Hyatt Hotel in LA across the street from
exactly.
House of Blues.
That's the
famously hotel. He would sort of hold court there for, you know, many, many years until he moved to Nashville. But
And Ike was living in San Marcos, but he came up and had stayed at that hotel, and I was staying at that hotel, but I didn't know Little Richard lived there until at that time.
Right.
But you're right.
Trying to imagine the forces of nature that were Little Richard and Jimi Hendrix on the same stage. That's way too combustible to sustain, I think.
Oh, I was thinking about, I can't remember, was it Robert Palmer that wrote that series about rock and roll where he talked about Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, and Little Richard as the three kind of pillars of the transformation of rhythm blues into rock and roll. And I remembered just... the nature of the individual made me feel like I understood his music because of his vitality And the fact that, you know, that was a long time ago. That was in the 1990s. And he made it to this year. But I don't know. There are others. I mean, I'm from Detroit. Sweet Pea Atkinson, who played with Don Was and had a couple of solo records himself, passed away this year. He was a Detroit voice.
If you want to talk about pioneers, you know, Charlie Pride, who just died, you know, recently. I was talking to a friend, actually had a friend of mine who's a country music sort of historian and journalist come on the radio show. And he said, you know, the thing about Charlie Pride is if you focus too much on his, you know, sort of on the cultural impact, you lose sight of how important he was to the music. And if you focus too much on the musical side, you know, you lose some sight of what he meant culturally. That, you know, what he did in terms of playing that Jackie Robinson role, and the guy was had been a baseball player, played in the Negro Leagues, you know, had visions of playing major league ball, but ended up singing instead. You know, the doors that he opened and the places that he went that, you know, nobody who looked like him had been and did not follow for many years. But then you go back and look at the success. I mean, the guy sold, he was the biggest selling artist on RCA Records other than Elvis for decades. And, you know, I can't remember this, but my friend Brian did this. He's like, not only did he have more gold records than, I forget the list, but then Loretta Lynn or Merle Haggard or Waylon Jennings or... you know, and he rattled off this whole list. He said he had more gold records than all of them combined. You know, it was a list of like 10 Hall of Famers. So the guy was, the impact was massive in ways that are measurable and not measurable.
Yeah, ma'am. Well, I mentioned, you know, my tour in your industry was through the blues. And there was one gentleman that had caught my fancy as a youngster. And as I got more involved, and I was making blues with black artists, traditional blues, working with Jim O'Neill, who had founded Living Blues magazine. But the one guy that just kept coming back that, you know, everybody would say, well, you know, Elvis is this guy that he covered the black rhythm and blues artists. He was an imitation, though. Some people, I talked to Puff Daddy about this once over at dinner, said that Eminem was one of the guys who actually earned the right to be in the front row because he gave so much. He was so vulnerable. Contributed. He was vulnerable. He had courage to tell his story that made everyone remark about how you say authentic his contribution was. But in the blues, there was one Caucasian named Peter Green, who had played with the Yardbirds and the original Fleetwood Mac and then had a solo career. But I remember with John Mayle, he made a song that was called Supernatural that just blew my mind when I was probably a sophomore in high school. And
a lot of those, you know, those Guitar Hero guys will say, you know, Peter Green was the one.
Green Monolishi with the two-prong crown. Yeah. And Love That Burns. There were so many songs that Albatross, the instrumental, whenever I sailed in the Southern Hemisphere, you'd see these 11-foot wingspan birds just soaring around. And that instrumental, I've used that in more, slideshows, PowerPoint presentations than probably any other song. But Peter disappeared from... this year, the Man of the World, Rattlesnake Shake,
he had disappeared from this world a long time
ago.
Yes,
he did. Unfortunately,
I mean, deeply troubled. You know, very, you know, very, very difficult life. You know, from very early on. I mean, from getting Fleetwood Mac up to, you know, starting to have some big hits, and then, you know, sort of had different spiritual slash drug awakenings that pulled him into different directions and never really resurfaced. I mean, it's fortunate, you know, certainly ironic that Mick Fleetwood dedicated a lot of time in the last couple of years to kind of celebrating Peter Green. He did a big photo book that was looking back at the Peter Green era of Fleetwood Mac. He put together a big tribute concert in February that did happen just before lockdown to pay tribute to Peter Green. And Kirk Hammett from Metallica was actually working on a project, I mean, with Peter. You know, we don't know what that means, how involved he was or what that was, but at least he got to have, you know, whatever it would have meant to him, a moment of recognition before he was gone. But as you say, I don't know if he was able to tap, you know, what you're talking about, tap into the blues in a way that resonated so strongly, even for the real blues players, you know, because he was coming from such a place of trouble and pain and struggle himself. You know, maybe that's the reason that his playing connected with those guys in that way, because this was not a guy who was learning or putting on or having to, you know, take himself to that place. He was, you know, he was clearly coming.
He was taking his wounds to the party, as they used to say.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember the other song I remember as a youngster really liking was played by, at the time, Carlos Santana, "Black Magic Woman," which was a Peter Green creation. But so that's another one that, how would I say, I will continue to listen to throughout all my days and be grateful for. But he departed this year. So next year, you've already alluded to the fact that next year people are going to be, how do I say, transformed by the experience of this year. If you had to predict what kind of music we're going to experience that is different than what we did this year, where would you go if you were?
God, it's a fascinating question, isn't it?
But let's put our prediction hat on, and you know, we can laugh at our errors when we meet next time.
Yeah, I mean, part of this, I feel, you know, I'll back it up to this thought first, which is that, you know, usually this time of year is about coming up with, you know, top 10 albums and top 10 singles or songs of the year. And again, there were so many albums that I, you know, that I really did respond to and spend time with and think that I will spend time with moving forward. Thinking about singles or single songs this year was really hard for me because, you know, like I said, all of the ways that you usually encounter those things are much more how they're out in the world. Things that you hear from, you know, booming out of cars that are passing by that catch your attention, or, you know, when you're out, when you're in a restaurant or when you're in a club, or what's playing on the, you know, before the band goes on stage, what are they playing in the venue, you know, before that. And not having any of those things, I felt like there were these whole swaths of, you know, of music that I just didn't like. For me, and some of this is just getting old, there were hip hop records that were important that connected with a lot of people this year, but not a lot for me, because the ways that I would hear that, you know, that I would hear those are not for me to sit at home with my, you know, with my family and listen to, you know, the Lil Baby record. Like, it's just not how I'm going to do that. So I felt very disconnected from other than things like the Run the Jewels record. And what a time where, you know, hip hop could be thriving and be such a voice for protest, for, you know, for social change and just mirroring the world and all of the things that hip hop has retained its power to do. So I do feel like as soon as, you know, whenever it is that the world opens back up, even partially again, that a lot of hip hop or a lot of hip hop and R&B created in response to, you know, the protest in the streets and the kind of dialogue we were having this year. I think a lot of that is still in front of us, which I would be really excited to hear and see where, you know, where that goes. because, like I said, I don't feel a lot of connection to that this year, again, largely through circumstance. But I think that clearly there's so much opportunity for those voices to, you know, to step forward now, you know, now more than ever. So I'm really interested to see where that side of things goes.
Well, Alan, there's a book that I've often gone back to and back to and back to, that's actually about poetry as a form of language and expression. Mm-hmm. It's by a woman named Muriel Rukeyser. It's called The Life mm-hmm. of Poetry. And the first part of the book is called The Resistances. And in the very first part, she talks about the fear of poetry and how hard it is to get out of ourselves. And I want to read you a couple of quotes from her writing about what happens in time of crisis to the mind and the emotion. And I think music is analogous to poetry in this regard. She says, "In times of crisis, we summon up our strength. Then if we are lucky, we're able to call every resource, every forgotten image that can leap to our quickening, every memory that can make us know our power. And this luck is more than it seems to be. It depends on the long preparation of the self to be used. In times of these crises of the spirit, we are aware of all our need for each other and our need for ourselves. We call up with all the strength of summoning we have, our fullness, and then we turn, for it is a turning that we have prepared, and we act. The time of the turning may be very long, and it may hardly exist. But in this moment, when we face horizons and conflicts wider than ever before, we want our resources, the ways of strength. We look again to the human wish, its faiths, the means by which the imagination leads us to surpass ourselves. If there is a feeling that something has been lost, it may be because much has not yet been used. Much is still to be found and begin again." And she talks explicitly about poetry as this other mm-hmm. kind of knowledge and love. And when it is hard to hold for a moment the giant clusters of event and the meaning that every day appear, it is time to remember poetry or music, that's my interjection, which has forever been a way of reaching complexes of emotion and relationship, the attitude that is like the attitude of science and the other arts today, but with significant and beautiful distinctness from these, the attitude that perhaps might equip our imagination to deal with our lives. I call it the attitude of poetry. I don't know a person who I would rather be talking to about these challenges, these questions, and the kind of spirit that the arts represent than you. I've learned a tremendous amount from you, going back to reading in Rolling Stone about Toad's Place, the Bob Dylan concert, where when I got the bootleg record of it, I was overjoyed.
Right.
And I understood that. Was that your first article that you wrote for Rolling Stone?
It wasn't. I'd written, you know, some other record reviews, little things, but witnessing that show was sort of my, you know, sort of my big
coming
break
out party
put me on the map over there.
Well, that's when you rose to the occasion at that extraordinary time. But I've watched and I've read your book on the song Hallelujah. I did a meditation last week where K.D. Lang sang Hallelujah in the background.
Mm-hmm. A beautiful one.
And just through conversation, through reading, and just through listening to you on your Sirius XM show, I'm a, as you know, a big student of music and the arts, and I try to infuse it into this realm of social science and the enlargement of the human challenges that we all face. But I don't have a better guide on earth than you. And I just want to thank you.
Well, thank you, and I'm honored, and the things that you've, you know, been able to, the places you've been able to take some of this stuff, the ways you've been able to inject it into I won't say broader efforts, but other efforts, is always extraordinary and inspiring. And, you know, what I would say coming off of those, you know, beautiful meditations from Rudolf Rukeyser, thinking about what this stuff means, is to be, you know, for it, those of us who grew up in the shadow of, you know, the greatest rock and roll generation, right? Who grew up in the shadow of the Beatles and the Stones and Dylan and Sly Stone and James Brown and, you know, the people you can point to and say they really did change the world with their music. They were dialed into where youth culture was. It was a common ground for a, you know, for a mass audience at a particular time that had to do with economy and demographics and so many of the things that you, you know, dedicate your study and your focus to. And to be realistic, for us to not just compare things to those artists and that moment, when I see, you know, crazy things this year, like the kids who are K-pop fans, who are, you know, Korean pop music fans, using their social media platforms to protest racism, to, you know, overload the ticketing sites for the Trump rallies to try to, you know, disrupt those kinds of gatherings. I mean, that's a really crazy and profound thing to think about, something that you would think about as the least politically engaged in terms of the literal music, but what is happening with community, what is happening with those kids trying to figure out how to respond to the world. When I see, you know, so many young, I mean, there's an odd thing in so much pop music right now where, you know, people that we would otherwise dismiss as very superficial, you know, top 40 dancey artists who are writing about anxiety and mental health and the issues that so many young kids are growing up with and facing. I think what's, you know, what's productive for us in terms of thinking about, you know, again, what that passage that you read about the sort of the turning of time for poetry and the places that it grapples with strife and tension and whatever is happening in the world, that's happening in, you know, not necessarily in the most predictable spots right now. And if those of us who have other examples of that can you know, can look to those places, find that inspiration, I think that there's a lot going on underneath the surface that's really interesting and hopeful, where you know, where we may not immediately, things may be moving faster than we think they are.
Well, I refer to you as my teacher, and I wanted to conclude this session with my theme song for the year, which I learned from my friend who lives in the Hawaiian Islands, Shep Gordon. Mm-hmm. And it's a Teddy Pendergrass song called "Wake Up, Everybody."
You and me both. I played this, I think, on New Year's Day this year. I went to it repeatedly. What a song that specifically talks about the teachers, the doctors, the elders. Yes. So many of the things that were in the crosshairs this year.
Well, you're a teacher, so I'm going to quote the first couple of verses. "Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed, no more backward thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. Now there's so much hatred, war, and poverty. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say, because they're the ones who's coming up. The world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can." And in the chorus, Pendergrass sings, "The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We got to change it, yeah. Just you and me." Thank you, my teacher.
Always, always a pleasure.
Talk again soon. We'll come back middle of next year and see how these artists have risen to the challenge and compare it again to Muriel Rukeyser and other beacons. of the way the arts are, which you might call our North Star.
We'll still be here. We'll still be listening.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.